Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am PGY1 transitional year resident that's going into radiology. This will be the 87th episode of the Divine Intervention podcast. This is actually coming exactly 4 days after our first year anniversary. So our first year anniversary was technically on the 14th of March, and we had 86 episodes in that 1 year. So I really, really hope I can beat that number in this new, I guess, Divine Intervention podcast year. But big thanks to everyone that has been listening, and I thank God everything has been going pretty smoothly. And if you have any suggestions for improvement, please feel free to send them my way. But in today's episode, I am going to start a new step one topic, and we're going to be talking about neurology, right? That's like a nebulous chapter in first aid. So we're going to try to break it down over a series of podcasts. So this will be the very first one. And I have some slides, and I'll go over some questions, but I'll use those questions to cover certain bits of information. So the first slide. So we have a 35-year-old female with a past medical history of Hashimoto's thyroiditis. Presents with a chief complaint of blurry vision in her left eye. A HEENT exam is positive for 20 over 200 vision in the left eye, but 20 over 25 vision in the right eye. She denies pain in the involved eye. 2 years ago, she had a 3-week episode of left arm weakness that resolved with high doses of prednisone. So what's your diagnosis, right? So hopefully this is screaming a lot like multiple sclerosis with optic neuritis, right? Remember, they have lesions that are separated in space and time. And I'll talk about these things as we proceed into this podcast and also like in future podcasts, right? And I mean, the pathophys is basically, it's almost like an autoimmune destruction of a person's, It's an autoimmune destruction, basically, of a person's like oligodendrocytes. And then, and again, I'll say some more stuff about this, but I just want to answer the questions first. And then, what is your diagnosis in a patient that recently had a viral upper respiratory infection, but presents with bilateral lower extremity weakness that has progressively gotten worse over the last 3 days? And let's assume this bilateral lower extremity weakness is ascending, right? This is more Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? And remember, the pathophys involves, again, it's sort of kind of like an autoimmune destruction or attack against like your Schwann cells. And I will give you some more details on this. I mean, sometimes you can attack like myelin proteins and there's molecular mimicry and all that stuff. But that's my basic surface answer for now. I will go deeper on Guillain-Barré syndrome and multiple sclerosis down the line. And then, what are the two major parts of the nervous system, right? So obviously, the central and peripheral nervous system. And big, big thing, central nervous system, for the most part, comes from the neural tube, okay? But the peripheral nervous system, for the most part, comes from the neural crest. So let's say a few more things about this, right? So let's sort of break this down a little, right? So we know that the nervous system, obviously, there's central nervous system that, again, for the most part, is like the brain and spinal cord, comes from the neural tube. And then we have the peripheral nervous system that is, for the most part, like, you know, like derived from neural crest, includes like cranial nerves like 1 through 12. Subtract cranial nerve 2 from that equation. I'll talk about why in a bit. And then also like those nerves that sort of come off the spinal cord, right? So your spinal nerves, those are also a part of the, peripheral nervous system. Now, the thing is, as you'll see later, right, neural crest gives rise to your peripheral nervous system, gives rise to your spinal nerves. But the thing is, the neural crest cell derivatives are things that are very high yield to actually know for step one, right? So things like your odontoblasts, they come from neural crest. All the postganglionic cells in your autonomic nervous system come from neural crest. Right. So say, for example, like your sympathetic nervous system. Remember, we have pre and post ganglionic. In your parasympathetic system, we have pre and post ganglionic. Those post ganglionic cells, they actually all come from the neural crest. All your cranial nerves, with the exception of cranial nerve 2 that comes from the diencephalon, they all come from neural crest. Right. So again, these are all high yield things to know. Remember, the chromaffin cells of your adrenal medulla. Your adrenal medulla is basically like a modified postganglionic sympathetic neuron. It also comes from neural crest. Now, And obviously, right, since we have a central nervous system, we should have cells that myelinate the neurons in the central nervous system, at least the axons in the central nervous system. And then we should also have a different cell type that myelinates the axons in the peripheral nervous system. The thing that does this job in the central nervous system is your oligodendrocyte. Okay, and the thing is, one oligodendrocyte can myelinate multiple axons. Okay, that's actually a very high yield thing to know for exams. So all the axons that constitute like your corticospinal tract, your corticobulbar tract, all these tracts that are all like descending coming from the brain, those tracts, those axons, they are all myelinated by oligodendrocytes. And then in the peripheral nervous system, the analogous cell is the Schwann cell. The Schwann cell myelinates only one single axon, okay? The Schwann cell myelinates only one single axon. So again, very high yield to know those for your tests, right? And we know that along those axons, those are either the Schwann cell or the oligodendrocyte, they sort of myelinate certain sections. They don't myelinate the entire axon. No, you don't want that, right? Because remember, fat is not super good for conducting electricity. So, you have myelination at different spots along the axon, but there are spots along the axon that don't have myelination, right? Those are your nodes of Ranvier. Remember, those nodes of Ranvier contain like voltage-gated sodium channels. And one high-yield thing you kind of want to know there is that those nodes of Ranvier, the concentration of the voltage-gated sodium channels is probably what matters the most. Because the thing is, if you don't have a high concentration of voltage-gated sodium channels and they're kind of like spread out along the axon, that is where you can begin to get into trouble, right? So take, for example, if a person has like multiple sclerosis, right, and they're basically having troubles with myelination, instead of those voltage-gated sodium channels to be all like locked in the nodes of Ranvier, they'll sort of be spread around the axon, and that basically shuts off saltatory conduction. So you have like slower conduction of neural impulses, and that is part of the pathophysiology behind some of the problems that are observed in multiple sclerosis. So multiple sclerosis, right, we know that it's essentially a disorder that affects derivatives of the central nervous system, right? So all those tracts, remember, those tracts start from like the brain, they start from like the cerebral cortex. So if they start from the cerebral cortex, it should make sense that those things should all be neurotube derived, right? So like your corticospinal tract, for example. So anything that's coming from your neurotube, right, from your central nervous system, you know, automatically it's myelinated by oligodendrocytes. And because multiple sclerosis is a central demyelinating problem, you have oligodendrocyte problems, so those tracts will begin to have issues, right? So, for example, those people have like lower extremity weakness, upper extremity weakness, blah, 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 right? Because their corticospinal tract is basically not well myelinated. If you notice, people with multiple sclerosis, in fact, like this example I give in this question, right? They tend to have optic neuritis. The reason they tend to have optic neuritis is because cranial nerve 2, the optic nerve, is actually one of those rare nerves, one of those cranial nerves. In fact, I will say probably the only cranial nerve that is not derived from neural crest. So all your other cranial nerves are derived from neural crest, right? Because remember, your cranial nerves are effectively the second order neurons in your corticobulbar tract. The first, if you wanted to say, Divine, you're confusing me a little. Let me explain for a bit. The thing is, if you look at your corticospinal tract, right, corticospinal starts in the cerebral cortex and is going towards the spinal cord, right? So the first order neurons in your corticospinal tract start in the precentral gyrus of the cerebral cortex. Those are your first order neurons. Those first order neurons, they are derived from neural tube, okay? But your corticospinal tract fibers, they ultimately go to the ventral horn of the spinal cord. Those alpha motor neurons that you find in the ventral horn of your spinal cord, guess where they're derived from? They're actually derived from neural crest. Okay, that's your corticospinal tract. So the first order neurons, neural tube, no issues there. But the second order neurons, which are the ventral horn alpha motor neurons, they are all derived from neural crest cells. So same thing with the corticobulbar tract. The thing is, your corticospinal tract is like the cerebral cortex controlling those alpha motor neurons. Your corticobulbar tract is your cerebral cortex controlling your cranial nerves, okay? So think of your cranial nerves as like a fancy schmancy kind of second order neuron. So your fancy schmancy cranial nerves are actually derived from neurocrest. You may say, Divine, this looks low yield. I promise you it's not low yield. It is actually very high yield to understand these things for your exam. So your cranial nerves are derived from neurocrest, okay, with the exception of cranial nerve 2. Cranial nerve 2, your optic nerve is actually derived from the diencephalon. Okay, it's actually derived from the diencephalon. So that's again a high yield thing you sort of want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. So where was I initially? So this is why patients with multiple sclerosis, they actually tend to get issues with the optic nerve, because the optic nerve, believe it or not, the axons of the optic nerve are actually myelinated by oligodendrocytes, because again, they're derived from the central nervous system neurotube. Okay, I know I'm spending time on this, but it's very important to understand that for your exams. And remember, right, the boss phrase you associate with a MS is like, oh, they have lesions separated in space and time. Of course, they have lesions separated in time because like the lesions tend to come and go. They're not like super persistent. Although that's not entirely true, but for step one purposes, that should be enough. But they also have lesions separated in space. And by that, what people usually mean is that they can have sensory symptoms or they can have motor symptoms. Alternatively, lesions separated in space can also be that they are like the issues they have are not symmetric, right? So it's rare to find, it's like they don't have like their two legs give out at the same time. No, today they may have like right lower extremity weakness. Tomorrow they may have like left upper extremity weakness, right? So they have those lesions sort of like separated in different parts of the nervous system. Okay, so again, those are high yield things you want to know. But contrast that with Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? So Guillain-Barré syndrome is like a peripheral demyelinating disorder. It's usually after like a viral upper respiratory infection or after like a GI tract infection. Classically on exams, think about a Campylobacter jejuni with a bloody diarrhea, right? Although that is now being de-emphasized on the USMLEs because they know that everyone has memorized that piece of information. So Guillain-Barré syndrome is more of a PNS demyelinating disorder. So it's more of a Schwann cell problem, okay? And I will tell you this, for the purposes of the USMLE, think of Guillain-Barré syndrome as a motor problem, okay? There are almost always never sensory deficits in Guillain-Barré syndrome on the USMLEs. That's a very high yield thing to know. For MS, it's different. MS, they can have sensory and motor issues, no problems. But Guillain-Barré syndrome, they tend to have only motor issues on the USMLEs, right? And again, it's usually an ascending paralysis. Starts distally and moves more proximally, right? And I mean, at some point, people with Guillain-Barré syndrome, if they're not treated on time, they may require intubation because remember, the phrenic nerve is a peripheral nerve, right? So they could scrub the phrenic nerve and then their diaphragms don't work as well anymore. And then they go into like respiratory failure, right? So again, those little things here and there that you definitely want to know, you definitely want to know for your exam. So I think that is all I want to say here. So I'm just going to go ahead and jump to the next question. So the next question is a matching game. And again, it's sort of kind of going to be like this, where basically I give questions, I'll answer them, but after I answer them, I'll sort of give like my reasoning and explain and then do some teaching, right? So matching game. So it says, given the following parameters, what is the most likely diagnosis, right? So the first one says increased acetylcholinesterase, increased alpha fetoprotein, and increased amniotic fluid index. Well, if you see this, increased amniotic fluid index is basically like MBME code word for polyhydramnios, okay? If you see that on an exam, I really hope you're thinking about an encephaly, okay? Because remember, your swallowing centers are gone. And if your swallowing center is gone, you won't be able to swallow your piss in utero. So you'll basically have polyhydramnios, okay? And I will explain why the acetylcholinesterase and the AFP are increased in a bit. Now, next question says, increased acetylcholinesterase, increased alpha-fetoprotein, amniotic fluid index is not increased. So this is actually more like spina bifida, like the super bad form of spina bifida, where, like, in fact, this is not a meningocele, this is not a myelomeningocele, this is not spina bifida occulta. This is like spina bifida where, like, literally the spinal cord is hanging out outside the body. It's not covered by like your meninges or anything like that. This is a super bad spina bifida. In fact, some people call it like spina bifida, I believe, with like myeloschisis or something like that. Okay, it's like super bad spina bifida. But again, your swallowing center is in your brain, right? It's not in your spinal cord. So because it's more of a spinal cord defect, these kids will not have polyhydramnios because they can swallow just fine. Now, what if a person has normal AFP, normal acetylcholinesterase, and they have like a tuft of hair on the lower back? This is more of spina bifida occulta. In fact, spina bifida occulta, many people classify it as a neurotube defect. It is technically not a neurotube defect, and you'll see why in a bit. Now, next one says increased alpha-fetoprotein, normal acetylcholinesterase levels, and it's associated with Chiari 2 malformations. I really, really hope you're thinking about like a myelomeningocele. Some people call it meningomyelocele, same thing. Especially lumbosacral myelomeningocele, those are associated with the Chiari 2 malformations. And I'll talk about the Chiari 2 malformations in a short while. Now, next one. Increased alpha-fetoprotein, normal acetylcholinesterase levels, not associated with Chiari 2 malformations. Well, if there's a Chiari 2 malformation, then that tells you that there should be a Chiari 1 malformation. And again, I'll explain all this shortly. And then, final one says increased AFP, ventral protruding structures on fetal ultrasound. This is probably more like gastroschisis, right? So you can see gastroschisis, because now this idea literally just popped into my mind, right? So gastroschisis, gastro, a part of your GI tract, schisis, protruding out of the body, not covered by a membrane, okay? Not covered by a membrane. Remember that super bad spina bifida I just talked about, that they call it spina bifida with myeloschisis. Myelo stands for spinal cord. Schisis means you're hanging out outside the body, but you're not sealed by a membrane. Okay, that's why that super bad spina bifida with myeloschisis actually has increased levels of acetylcholinesterase. Because really, if your dura, or to be, I guess, a little more specific, if your arachnoid is covering the spinal cord, is covering like neural elements, CSF will not leak. Again, this is a simplified explanation, but it should be more than ample for your USMLEs. CSF will not leak, and guess what? If CSF does not leak, you will not have elevations in your acetylcholinesterase. Okay, so again, high yield to kind of understand that. So, so myeloschisis, spinal cord, outside the body, not covered, versus gastroschisis, GI tract, outside the body, not covered. Another thing that could also be responsible for the final answer I have here is omphalocele, although remember that is sealed by a peritoneal membrane, although that is not sealed by skin. So because it's not sealed by skin, which is a derivative of a ectoderm, your alpha fetoprotein levels will be high. So let's talk about these topics real quick, right? So the thing is, I'll have an embryology podcast in the future, but remember that in the formation of the neural tube, we sort of go through certain processes. In fact, I will encourage you to maybe go to the next slide and let's talk through those processes, right? So the thing is, your nervous system comes from ectoderm, simple as that, right? Your ectoderm, and the thing is, it's ectoderm like on the dorsal surface of your body, okay? Kind of important to know that ectoderm on the dorsal surface of the body. Right? Because if you notice, I've been saying, oh, neurotube defects cause increased AFP, but gastroschisis and omphalocele cause increased AFP. The thing is, some of these neurotube defects, think of them more as like dorsal body wall defects. Basically, if you ever have a body wall defect, your alpha fetoprotein will rise, okay? But you can have dorsal body wall defects like your neurotube defects, or you can have ventral body wall defects like gastroschisis and omphalocele. Okay, so that's kind of like they're all one and the same thing. It's just, oh, is it the front of your body? That's a ventral body wall defect. Is it the back of your body? That's a dorsal body wall defect. So we have ectoderm again on the dorsal side of the person in utero. And then you have something called a neuroplate. No one really cares much about that. But the thing is, the neuroplate invaginates. And when that neuroplate invaginates, right, you form something called a neurogroove, right? Groove is like a valley, right? So you have the neurogroove, and then on either side of that neurogroove, you have neurofolds. And the thing is, the most, think of them as like the outermost parts of those neurofolds are basically your future neurocrest. Please excuse these boxes over some of the letters. I tried to sneak this from OneNote, but these text boxes kept popping up. I know I could pull off those text boxes in an older episode of Office, but I can't necessarily do it now. So I'll try and figure it out for hopefully the next podcast. Because for this neuro podcast, I probably have to do a lot of drawing just because of the way neuro is, unfortunately. So we have the future neural crest, right? And then the thing is, this neural groove will ultimately close to form a tube. Okay, so remember, it's a tube. So that tube has a hollow on the inside. That hollow on the inside will ultimately become like the ventricles, okay, and also like the central canal of the spinal cord. So we have the neural tube closing, right? But the thing is, the closing is like a stage closure, right? So I sort of think of it like a surgeon. Like surgeons, there are certain surgeries where like they do things in stages. They don't just do everything at once, right? They do like stage closure of fascia or whatever, right? Same thing here, right? You have like a stage closure of the neural tube. The thing is, the middle part of the neural tube closes first, which is kind of weird, right? But that's just how it happens. The middle part closes first, and then you keep going. And then your cranial part or your rostral part closes second. And then your caudal part closes third, right? And the thing is, again, remember, your neural crest is kind of excluded from this neural tube. So because it's excluded, it's not like kept in the family. It can wander and go anywhere in the body that it wants to. That's why it literally wanders to like, goes to adrenal gland, sets up shop in the medulla, becomes chromaffin cells, stuff like that. And the thing is, overlying all of this, I mean, like, you don't have your spinous processes, like, literally sticking out of your body. The reason that is because the remaining ectoderm, right, sort of covered over your spinous processes, so you don't have those things sticking out, okay? So, you need that ectoderm to cover things over. If ectoderm does not cover things over, that is a body wall defect. And if you have a body wall defect, guess what happens? Your AFP goes up, okay? But again, remember, a body wall defect is not the same thing as an open neurotube defect. It is when your body wall is exposed, like basically ectoderm does not cover things over. That is where you get into elevated AFP, okay? But if your dura and your arachnoid and whatnot are covering over your neural elements, then acetylcholinesterase is not going to leak out. That's why acetylcholinesterase is more like elevations in amniotic fluid acetylcholinesterase is more specific for neurotube defect versus elevations in AFP. AFP can be elevated for like many reasons, right? I don't know, Down syndrome, gastroschisis, omphalocele, whatever. Okay, so it's, again, these are subtle points, but the thing is, sometimes it's these subtle points that really helps with ultimately understanding certain bits of information, as you'll see in the next slide. We will for sure talk about these things. So I think I've covered most of what I want to say there, right? So again, just to summarize, right? So your nervous system comes from ectoderm, right? And again, remember, ectoderm is one of those three germ layers, right? That initially starts from the process of gastrulation, where you form like ectoderm, endoderm, mesoderm, right? So ectoderm forms your entire nervous system. But the thing is, don't forget though, your mesoderm sort of kind of contributes, right? So it's like if you want your neurotube to form, right, it needs to receive signals, right? Someone needs to tell it, okay, neurotube, time to form. The thing that does that is actually notochord. And notochord, it's actually like floridly high yield to know for exams that it is derived from mesoderm. Okay, that sonic hedgehog business that you probably learned about in embryology, sort of kind of related to the notochord, which is from mesoderm, which again induces the ectoderm to go ahead and form the neural tube, right? And again, remember, you go through a neural plate first, that invaginates you from the neural grooves. We have the neural crest on the outermost portions of those neural folds, and then you close. You have a staged closure. Right, you have like middle first, and then rostral second, and then caudal third. Okay, and remember that your neural crest cells can migrate and do a lot of wonderful things. So let's talk, I guess, let's say some more things about this staged closure, right? So what if your rostral neural tube fails to close, right? So like your rostral neural pore doesn't close. If it doesn't close, that's what creates an encephaly. Right. So basically, these people, like most of their brain above the brain stem is really not there. Right. So and remember, your swallowing center is sort of kind of part of your cerebral cortex. So because they can't swallow, they will have polyhydramnios. And because, right, I mean, literally, like whatever is left of their brain is exposed, is not covered by ectoderm. Right. That is sort of kind of like a body wall defect. So their AFP will be high. But think about it. If your cerebral cortex is not there, what is also not there? Right, the pia and arachnoid and whatever that overlies your cerebral cortex will obviously not be there. So if those things are not there, guess what happens? Your CSF will leak, and if CSF leaks, your acetylcholinesterase levels in the amniotic fluid will be high. Okay, now what if your caudal neural pore fails to close? Your caudal neural pore. What if it fails to close? So the thing is, how do I put this? Okay, let's put it this way. So let's say your caudal neural pore fails to close and there's no ectoderm overlying it, and your meninges, your spinal cord, basically like your spinal, it's almost like an encephaly, but in a lower part of the body. So it's like literally like there are actually no meninges covering your spinal cord. Your spinal cord is literally like left out to hang out to dry outside your body. Right. So obviously you have a body wall defect because your spinal cord is hanging out. So your AFP will be high. And because your spinal cord is hanging out, not necessarily covered by meninges, right? Your acetylcholinesterase level in the maternal amniotic fluid will also be elevated. But these people will not have polyhydramnios. So the amniotic fluid index should be normal. Okay. Because again, they can swallow just fine. Okay. But before I talk about the other neural tube defects, I think it probably is instructive to sort of dovetail and discuss one thing real quick, right? And the thing that I sort of kind of want to discuss real quick is the whole concept of a vertebral arch, right? So the thing is, in embryology, right? So you have your vertebral bodies. You all know what a vertebral body is. The thing is, the vertebral body, a neural arch, or some people call it like a vertebral arch, sort of grows out from it, right? And the thing is, a vertebral arch, I would encourage you maybe look up a picture of this online. I should probably have drawn a picture, but I don't really have time for that. I need to get to other things soon. But basically, your vertebral arch is made up of two laminae. So just sort of think of it as like a triangle. Your neural arch, your vertebral arch, envision it as a triangle. So this is me trying to describe what I should have drawn, right? Think of it as a triangle. We have like those two sides. I mean, think of two sides as the laminae. Okay, so like individual lamina. So like two individual lamina, they form two sides of the triangle. And then sort of think of your spinous process as forming the third part, the third leg of that triangle. So the thing is, if you have problems with that process of forming your vertebral arch, that is where you can actually begin to get into trouble, right? So for example, if those two lamina form, but the spinous process does not form over it, then you essentially have like two legs of a triangle, but you don't have the third leg of that triangle. So because you have two legs, that's why that caudal neural tube defect. For the most part, they are called spina bifida, right? Bifid. Bi means two. So you have two legs of that triangle that are sticking out. The third part is not necessarily showing up as it should to sort of complete the triangle that constitutes your neural arch. So, let's sort of talk about these neural tube defects in stages, right? So I've talked about the first one where you have the spina bifida with myelosuccesis, right? Where basically the spinal cord is just literally hanging out outside the body. That's bad. AFP is up. Acetylcholinesterase is up. And that's actually the least common, thankfully, right? I mean, that's obviously like pretty bad, right? It's like the least common. And that's actually an example of an open neural tube defect because, again, the spinal cord is hanging out, okay? And it's not covered by meninges. That's an open neural tube defect. Now, if you have issues that revolve more around you forming that vertebral arch, that neural arch, right? That's more of like a bony defect. That begins to open up avenues for things to sort of like go out of their normal place, okay? So, again, let me explain this. If that neural arch does not form, right? You can have things still stay in their normal place, like your spinal cord stays in its normal place, your meninges stay in their normal place. With that, you have no issues, right? It's like your ectoderm will form normally because there's nothing that has like herniated out of that vertebral arch, out of that neural arch, and you're fine. That would be spina bifida occulta, right? Because there's nothing taking the place of that ectoderm, so normal ectoderm just goes and forms over it, right? But let's take things up a notch. What if through that, because the third leg of that triangle did not form, some of your meninges decided to sort of herniate out through the place where your spinous processes should have been? If meninges herniate out, guess what happens? You have something known as meningocele. And because something has taken the space that should ordinarily have been taken by ectoderm, ectoderm does not overlie that defect, and the person has meningocele. And because ectoderm did not cover over the defect, that person will have increased levels of alpha fetoprotein, okay? But let's take things up a notch even more. What if you have your meninges sticking out through that spinous process? Basically, your spinous process is not where it should be. So you have your meninges sort of sticking out. And then in addition to that, you have your spinal cord also sticking out, right? But still covered over by meninges. Again, those things have taken spots that should have been taken by ectoderm. So ectoderm does not overlie the defect. So guess what happens? The person also has an increase in AFP. But the thing is, meninges are still covering the spinal cord just fine. So the levels of amniotic fluid acetylcholinesterase do not rise under those circumstances. Again, let me repeat this, right? Normally, from your vertebral body, okay, you have a triangle that grows out of your vertebral body. Okay, think of your vertebral body as not being part of this triangle. You have a triangle growing out. In fact, you know what, to make this easy, because I don't have the diagram drawn, I think I'll just go ahead and draw a diagram and put it in the final slide set I post. But basically, from your vertebral bodies, you form a neural arch, okay, or vertebral arch, one and the same thing. And those arches are made of, think of them as three sides of a triangle. If two sides develop, but one side does not, okay, you have something called spina bifida, okay? Now, the thing that can happen is through that defect, your spinal cord can entirely be lying outside the body, not covered by meninges, nothing. That's spina bifida with myelosuccesis. And I already explained like the terminology, like the wording with that, right? With that, your spinal cord is just literally like lying out, like literally hanging out on the floor outside of the body, right? So it's not covered by meninges. So as your acetylcholinesterase levels will be up. And it's also not covered by ectoderm because it's like the place that ectoderm should have covered over is not right, right? It has been taken up by something else. So your AFP levels also go up. Now, that's the most severe, and thankfully, that's the least common kind of spina bifida, right? But if we then go a little, if we say, okay, you know what? What if we have that problem, like we have the two like the laminae, like two sides of the triangle form. The third side doesn't form, like basically where your spinous processes should be. But everything stays in their normal place. Spinal cord stays in place. Meninges stay in place. That is spina bifida occulta. Okay. And because everything stays in place, your ectoderm is like, oh, well, there's no spinous process here to sort of cover over the back. But you know what? There's nothing taking my space. So ectoderm forms right over it. So guess what? In spina bifida occulta, your AFP levels are not up because ectoderm covers over the defect. And your acetylcholinesterase levels are not up because everything is in its normal place. The spinal cord is completely covered by meninges. But let's up the ante a notch, right? So what if we say that, you know what? Through that spot where the spinous process should have been as a constituent of your vertebral arch, meninges herniate through that defect. If meninges herniate through that defect, that's called a meningocele. But because those meninges are taking the space that should have been taken by ectoderm, ectoderm has no ability to cover over that defect. So because ectoderm does not cover over that defect, those kids will have elevations in their AFP, but they will not have elevations in the acetylcholinesterase because that acetylcholinesterase is elevated if you have a CSF leak. And that CSF leak happens if your dura, or if you want to be a little more specific, your arachnoid, does not cover your spinal cord. Now, let's up the ante up even more, right? What if your meninges and your actual spinal cord are herniating through that region that should have been taken over by your spinous processes? That's what's known as a myelomeningocele, okay? Or a meningomyelocele, whatever. Doesn't matter, okay? Again, that will take up the spot that should have been taken up by ectoderm to cover over the defect. So ectoderm does not cover over the defect. So guess what? Your AFP goes up. And then your acetylcholinesterase actually does not go up. Okay, your acetylcholinesterase does not go up. And my reasoning behind that is because even if your spinal cord and your meninges have herniated out, your spinal cord is still covered over by the meninges, like your dura, arachnoid, and pia. Okay, so you don't have CSF leaks technically. And if you don't have CSF leaks, guess what does not happen? You do not have, elevations in the amniotic fluid acetylcholinesterase. Again, that is super, 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 super high yield to know for exams. You may not necessarily need to know it, but the thing is, it's high yield to understand, right? And the thing is, if you really think about it, if your friends at the MBME wanted to be mean, they could very easily put the matching game questions that I put, like sort of make it like an arrow sort of question on your test, right? And the thing is, this is where you then see who really understands these neurotube defects and who really does not understand these neurotube defects. Because everyone has memorized like some basic things like, oh, AFP is up, acetylcholinesterase is up. The thing is, it's not every neurotube defect that is associated with elevations in your acetylcholinesterase. That's just the fact of life, right? So again, that is specifically why I put this question. So sort of bring out and buttress these points so you really understand them. So I think that's really all. I guess I could summarize because I even have like a neuro defect algorithm, right? So I say, is your AFP elevated? If the answer to that is no, right, then that tells you that you have no body wall defect, right? So everything is covered over nicely by ectoderm. It could also mean that you have spina bifida occulta, right? And again, I've explained the reasoning behind that, right? But if your AFP is elevated, it could mean one of two things. It could mean that you have a ventral, it could actually mean many things, okay? But just to dumb down this discussion, let's say it could mean you could have like a ventral body wall defect, like gastroschisis and omphalocele. Remember, again, omphalocele is sealed by peritoneum, gastroschisis is not. Although omphalocele tends to be associated with more like congenital defects than gastroschisis, but that's a different discussion. But another reason your AFP could be elevated could be from a dorsal body wall defect, so defect in the back, right? Now, the thing is, I divide those dorsal body wall defects into open neurotube defects, where you have increases in your amniotic fluid acetylcholinesterase, and closed neurotube defects, where you do not have increases in your amniotic fluid acetylcholinesterase, okay? And under the open neurotube defect, the next question you ask yourself is, Do they have polyhydramnios? If they do, they could say polyhydramnios on the MBNE, or they could try to mess with your head by putting, oh, an increase in the amniotic fluid index, right? Because remember, your friends at the MBNE, if they run out of ways to test things, they can then just begin to change like the words, right? So for example, they could do things like, instead of saying like sarcoma bodies, they can put laminated calcifications. Those are a classic thing they do on exams, right? So polyhydramnios, increased amniotic fluid index mean one and the same thing, okay? If you see that, that's an encephaly. Remember, their swallowing center is gone. And then contrast that with no polyhydramnios. If they have like increases in AFP and acetylcholinesterase, think more about like the super severe spina bifida. So spina bifida with myeloschisis, okay? Now, if you're thinking about closed neural tube defects, the acetylcholinesterase is not elevated in, is not, basically is normal in both of these problems, but you could have like this cystic expansion that contains only meninges. That's a meningocele, okay? Or you can have this cystic expansion. In fact, sometimes people call this like spina bifida cystica, okay? You can have this cyst-like expansion that contains like your meninges and your like legit spinal cord, okay? That's a meningomyelo. So remember, the word myelo literally stands for spinal cord. Okay, and remember that lumbosacral myelomeningocele have an association with the Chiari 2 malformations. In fact, I should probably go ahead and talk about those Chiari malformations. In fact, you know what? Let me just go ahead and do it now. So those Chiari malformations, basically, they're problems where your cerebellum herniates downward into the foramen magnum. Okay, but remember, your cerebellum has multiple parts, right? You have like your cerebella tonsils that are a little more lateral. You have your cerebella vermis that's a little more like in the midline. Okay, so the thing is, if it's your cerebella tonsils that are herniating, downward through the foramen magnum, that's a Chiari 1 malformation. In fact, it's actually the most common kind of Chiari malformation. And usually this tends to not be super clinically significant for the most part, although these Chiari 1 malformations can actually be associated with syringomyelia, okay? So that's something to sort of keep at the back of your mind. Now, if you have your cerebellar vermis instead being the thing that's herniating downwards, that's more of a Chiari 2 malformation. And the thing is, because your cerebellar vermis is like kind of central, especially in the posterior fossa, it's more prone to sort of like blocking your fourth ventricle. So the thing is, your Chiari 2 malformation or your anal Chiari 2 malformation, for the most part, tends to be more associated with hydrocephalus. And I mean, if you want to be more exact, a non-communicating or an obstructive hydrocephalus. Okay, so these people could have hydrocephalus, so they could have increased intracranial pressures. And remember that this is the one that is also associated with a lumbosacral myelomeningocele. And then I guess another one that occasionally confuses people is like a Dandy-Walker malformation. Basically, the thing that happens here is like, remember the way CSF flows, right? So it starts in the two lateral ventricles. Remember, the reason you have two lateral ventricles is because you have two cerebral hemispheres, right? So you have two cerebral hemispheres, so each one should have a lateral ventricle. And then from the two lateral ventricles, you send things through the interventricular foramen of Monroe, and then you go to the third ventricle. And then from the third ventricle, you go to the cerebral aqueduct of Sylvius, which is a part of the midbrain, part of the mesencephalon. And then from the cerebral aqueduct of Sylvius, you go to the fourth ventricle. Right, and then the fourth ventricle drains into the subarachnoid, through the arachnoid granulations into the subarachnoid space, through like the midline foramen of Majendie, and then the lateral foramen of Luschka. Remember, Majendie has an M, median has an M, Luschka has an L, lateral has an L. Okay, so there are two foramina of Luschka and one foramina of Majendie. And the thing is, if you actually have like a congenital obstruction of like the foramen of Majendie or the foramina of Luschka, you can actually basically have like a lot of CSF backing up in the fourth ventricle in utero. And if that CSF begins to back up, your fourth ventricle will essentially dilate, and that can cause like really, really bad hydrocephalus. I mean, this will be an obvious example of, again, another like non-communicating, or you can say obstructive hydrocephalus, okay? That's more of the Dandy Walker syndrome. It's like a cystic expansion of the fourth ventricle. And again, usually arises because your foramen of Majdani or your lateral foramen of Luschka just congenitally do not open, okay? And then you get into trouble. And I guess so that I can know that I'm pretty set from a neuroembryology standpoint, I guess I can also discuss holoprosencephaly, right? So again, remember I said that you have two cerebral hemispheres, right? I mean, they are separated by the foci cerebri, which is like a dural fold. Normally, those cerebral hemispheres, they start out as one unit and then they separate. If they don't separate, you have like one big cortex. That's what's known as holoprosencephaly, okay? It's very common actually in trisomy 13. That's Patau syndrome, okay? So it's just or Patau syndrome, depending on where you come from in the world. That's holoprosencephaly. Those kids tend to have like cleft lip, cleft palate, and all that badness. So, I said that of the Chiari malformations, right? I said that Chiari 1 is more common and tends to be less symptomatic than Chiari 2. And if you're looking at those like other neural tube defects, right? So I said like, if you're looking at those caudal neural tube defects, right? So like spinal bifida or myeloscisis is the least common caudal neural tube defect. Actually, the most common caudal neural tube defect is spina bifida occulta, right? Where you just have that tuft of hair. Nothing is anything out. Ectoderm covers over the spinal cord just fine, okay? And then we're left with two. Between the last two, between like a meningocele and a myelomeningocele, the worst one, actually, myelomeningocele, is actually more common than meningocele, okay? So that's something to know. I guess another thing I could also talk about is, I mean, this is something that will probably take me like a minute. So remember that neural tube, right? So I said that neural tube your neural tube forms your brain and your spinal cord, right? So it's actually the more rostral or the more cranial part of your neural tube that forms the brain. The more caudal portions form the spinal cord, okay? And the thing is that more rostral portion, right, it sort of breaks up into like vesicles. There's like primary vesicles, there's three of those, and then those primary vesicles break down even further to secondary vesicles, and there's five of those. Basically, like the first primary vesicle forms two things, the third primary vesicle forms two things, the second primary vesicle does not form any other thing, okay? The first primary vesicle is like your forebrain, that's like your prosencephalon, right? From your prosencephalon, right, you form like the telencephalon that essentially includes like your, you know, both of your cerebral hemispheres, your two lateral ventricles are sort of like those hollows inside that tube, right? Those essentially all come from the telencephalon. The telencephalon is a derivative of your prosencephalon. And then another derivative, right? So this other secondary vesicle that comes from your prosencephalon is your diencephalon, right? And your diencephalon, basically forms everything that has like thalamus in his name, right? So like your pineal gland, technically your pineal gland is called like the epithalamus, is right from the diencephalon. Your hypothalamus, right, that basically controls your autonomic nervous system and like all pretty much every endocrine function in your body for the most part, okay? I know that's not entirely true. Comes from the diencephalon. Your subthalamus, right? We'll talk about the subthalamic nucleus when we get to like basal ganglia and all that weird circuitry. Those all come from the diencephalon. And also, don't forget, cranial nerve 2, super high yield to know this. The optic nerve comes from the diencephalon, okay? It is the only cranial nerve that is derived from the central nervous system. The other cranial nerves, guess what? They are derived from the peripheral nervous system. So they're derived from neurocrest cells. Again, super high yield to know that for exams. And for the most part, your diencephalon contains the third ventricle, Okay. And then the second primary vesicle, right, is your mesencephalon. Your mesencephalon, your mesencephalon basically forms your midbrain, okay? And your mesencephalon, right, doesn't develop even further into like secondary vesicles. It just stays as mesencephalon, has midbrain, and doesn't have a part of the ventricle in it, just has the cerebral aqueduct of Sylvius. And then your final primary vesicle, right, is your rhombencephalon. And your rhombencephalon gives rise to two secondary vesicles. Those two secondary vesicles are your metencephalon and your myelencephalon. Your metencephalon includes, so contains a T, basically is your pons and cerebellum. And then your myelencephalon is your medulla, okay? And basically those two things like you contain like the fourth, your fourth ventricle. So, I think with that, I think I'm probably going to go ahead and stop. And again, as I always mention, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE Step 1, 2CK, 2CS, and 3 exams. And then I offer tutoring for like the preclinical med school exams, the third year shelf exams, and weirdly for organic chemistry, and also for the internal medicine in-training exam, and the internal medicine board exams. So I do actually offer tutoring for those. And then I've been on the admissions committee of like a top 3 medical school. So I prepare ERAS applications for med students trying to become residents, and then AMCAS applications for college students trying to become med students. I do like interview prep. I help with like editing personal statements, preparing applications, checking them, presenting your strengths in like the best way possible. So those are things I'll do. So if you know anyone that needs any of those things by any chance, let me know. But I really hope you got something from this podcast. If you have any questions, let me know. Neuro will be a pretty long series of podcasts because neuro is literally 10% of first aid. So I will see you in the next podcast. Have a wonderful rest of the day and God bless you. See you next time. Thanks.